This is Christopher Bandini from New Books in Psychoanalysis, and I'm here today with Naoko Wake, Associate Professor of History at Michigan State University. Her field is the history of medicine, gender, sexuality in the United States and the Pacific Rim, and she is the author of Private Practices, Harry Stack Sullivan, The Science of Homosexuality and American Liberalism. That's published by Rutgers in 2011, and the co-author with Shinpei Takeda of Hiroshima Nagasaki Beyond the Ocean by Yorori Books, 2014. She is currently working on her second monograph, Bombing Americans, Gender, and Trans-Pacific Remembering After World War II, which explores the history of Japanese-American and Korean-American survivors of the atomic bomb with a focus on the cross-national and gendered memory, identity, and activism. We're here today to talk about her first book, Private Practices, Harry Stack Sullivan, The Signs of Homosexuality and American Liberalism. So welcome, Dr. Wake.
Thank you, Chris. Glad to be here.
Great. So let's start off, which is customary when we do these interviews at New Books in Psychoanalysis, is to ask you, what led you to write this book?
Well, it has a long history. So it started out when I went to college in Kyoto and picked up a book that was actually a translated version of Harry Stack Sullivan's Schizophrenia as a Human Process. And somehow the title very much spoke to me. Not that I was a psychology or psychiatry major at that point, but I think I was interested in people's mind and the way it works. And I'm kind of looking for a theory that makes sense to me that explains it. And I think it's a very, useful interest on my part. I think, college-age students are often interested in those things, interested in people and their minds and so forth. And somehow, Harry Stack Sullivan's interpersonal theory of mental illness very much made sense to me. And I think what was standout for me at that point was how, in quote-unquote, despite the fact he was American, he was very much interested in understanding mental illness from interpersonal perspective. My very limited understanding of American history and American culture people at the time was that it was very much based on individualism. So I got really curious about how come this person is trying to understand American people by looking at their interpersonal relationship. So that's how it started out. And I think it was back in 1995, '96, around that time. So I wrote a thesis at the time of my graduation, and I studied further about Harry Stack Sullivan in my master's program at Kyoto. And then I decided that, I was looking into his clinical records. That's one of the things that I think I really spent a lot of time thinking about in my process of thinking and writing a book. To have an access to clinical records of Sullivan, you have to go to his mental hospital, a mental hospital he used to work at as a psychiatrist. So that's the reason why I came here with a determination to finish up this project. So that's how I guess it's a long version of how I got interested in the book.
How many years did it take to write the book?
So if you just focus on the writing itself, I guess it was after I became ABD, all but dissertation. So that happened 2002. And dissertation was completed in 3 years. And then it took me several years after that, after my degree in 2005, to complete the book in 2011. So in total, it's quite a bit of time, I guess, from 2002 to 11, it's 9 years. But as I said earlier, my relationship to the project really started much earlier. So it's been a long time. Well, I'm glad that the book is published now, but it was definitely one of the longest projects I ever engaged myself with.
It really comes across in the book how extensive the work was. So you traveled to Chestnut Lodge, and then you met with several people who knew Harry Stack Sullivan or who had been supervised by him. Is that correct?
I never actually went to Chestnut Lodge Hospital. I actually did most of my work at Shepherd and Enoch Pratt Hospital.
Oh, okay.
yes, right. So that's where I met most of the people I talked to. when I say they, I mean psychiatrists who, many of them are now retired, but psychiatrists who were, you know, seeing patients at the hospital during the time I was doing the research for my dissertation. So they really helped me to have a better sense of what's there as available resources for historians to look at. But also other people, you know, offer me a place to stay. And I got to know a lot of people thanks to those interactions. So I'm very deeply appreciative of that.
Yeah, there's really some incredible living history in the book. I believe you spoke to Ralph Crowley, was somebody from – did you also went to White? Is that correct? Did you
– Yes, I did, yeah.
So White had certain records and Shepard Pratt had other had the clinical records, and you reviewed both of them.
Exactly. So White Institute was very much institutional record. So you got the better – pretty good sense of, you know, who was meeting with whom for what intellectual and clinical purposes. I didn't have an access to the patient records there because it really didn't function as a mental hospital or a clinic at the time. It was more of an institutional institution when Cyron was there. But I did have an access to clinical records that really showed you know, word-for-word interactions between doctors and patients, including Sullivan and his patients. So that was really a gold mine for me as a historian, as a source of information. But also I think it's important that I had an access to both of them because, you know, you have to have a both big and more close-up pictures to write a good history.
And were you familiar with the other work that people have done on Sullivan, the Zwick Perry biography? I guess there was one by A.E. Chapman was another one. But your work is quite different, actually.
Yeah, I think in all many different ways, I am different, and that was part of the challenging and but also exciting part of working on this project. So looking at clinical records so extensively. Was one of the biggest differences that I had from any previous work written about Sullivan. But I think also issues of homosexuality, how are we to understand a famous medical doctors or any famous figures' sexuality, which was very much considered to be a private issue that shouldn't be, be even seen or being explored by anybody who are outsiders. How do we actually write about it in a way that makes sense to us, in a way that actually help us better understand Sullivan and his world, was another big challenge and new element in my work.
Did you know the premise as you, or did it come as you were doing the research? That actually, and the title of the book is Private Practice, the sense that he did one thing in public and one thing and work and lived differently in private. Was that something you discovered as you went along?
Yeah, exactly. First I was actually going to just look at how his, published work that talked about his interaction with patients may be similar to and different from his clinical practices. And that was the purpose for me to look at clinical records at Shepard Pratt. And I think it was actually after I was, or right around the time I became an ABD, so 2001 or 2002 even, when I finally had a full access to all the clinical records from the 1920s and early part of the 1930s as well. And one day I just discovered a bunch of clinical records that did include records of patients who were described to be suffering from in quotation marks, obviously, because that was medical perception at the time, suffering from their homosexual inclinations. Those are the terms that medical doctors of Shepard Pratt used at that time. So they didn't use the word homosexuality, but given their words, patients' words, their description of their feelings and experiences, it was clear that this is going to be a big issue that anybody who looks at the history of this nature would have to think about. So I was actually taken by surprise. I knew that Sullivan, Harrington's theory, if in a very limited way, suggests his struggle with his sexuality, and Chapman's work that you mentioned earlier as well. So I knew that, he was a sexual minority, even though, of course, people didn't use that term at that point. He was a gay psychiatrist. But I guess I didn't know exactly what kind of primary sources existed when I started out this project, only to realize very much later in my work that, yes, I have to think about how to talk about this because the evidence is here. So yeah, you're right. This is something that showed up along the way as I dug deeper into the archive.
It's interesting because so much of Sullivan, I think, is, well, many people know some of the facts of his life. A lot of it is there's certain idealization and kind of a mythical sense that has come around him that kind of excludes the things that you were talking about. So it was very interesting to kind of see that there was really this other piece. I was thinking of the clinic, the all-male clinic, and I had never really thought about this before, about why he had kind of structured it that way, and also how it closed. And there were, you know, there are many instances like that of why he would choose to do something, and a lot of it's kind of mysterious.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, but I think I also got a sense of how some doctor-patient interactions, but also patient-to-patient interactions, might have had therapeutic values for them. I mean, this was a very different kind of time in terms of American society's understanding and approach to issues of sexual diversity. Not that things are ideal now, but 1920s, this is the time when there were still ideas about, you know, sexual minorities as sinners and criminals, and it was being replaced by the idea that there, as a matter of fact, mentally ill rather than sinners in a religious sense. So they were sort of trying to, the idea itself of talking about their same-sex sexual relations and feelings in interacting with a psychiatrist was in itself very new and probably scary thing, a courageous thing to do. And this is an environment that, even though it's a, I'm not trying to idealize mental hospitals here because people did feel that they were being stigmatized just by the fact of being sent there. And yet, what they found out is that sometimes they found themselves to be surrounded by people who held similar feelings about their own sexuality, probably even had similar experiences of having sexual encounters with a person of same sex. And a psychiatrist seems to know very much of the similar kinds of things as well. I think it was a very special and surprisingly, I'm struggling for a word here, accepting maybe is the word I'm looking for, given the time for people who had those kinds of experiences. So that was a pleasure for me to kind of start to have the sense, even though you're right, I think Sullivan was very good at compartmentalizing his ideas and relationship with people. So for him, I think clinical setup at Shepard Pratt was more or less a protected environment.
He would also kind of move on from one environment to another. Like, I guess it closed it closed kind of quickly, or he was kind of moved someplace else. And then he came to New York as well, right? And worked in New York privately.
Right. And I think, and I hope that my book makes it clear that that's when his interaction with students, he was, training as a psychoanalyst at that point. as well as his relationship to students, clearly became highly ethically problematic, because there was a lack of, clearly stated informed consent prior to having sexual interactions or relationship with some of his students and patients. So, but I think I like to really emphasize how, as a historian, not as a clinician, but as a historian, I see it's important to know there are different kinds of things happen when sexual relationship occurs, be it between patient and patient or between doctors and patient. I don't want to be the person who makes a quick judgment and move on because we feel superior. We have a better ethical standard now, more, considerate and thoughtful, patient rights oriented conduct, code of conduct. And I think it's true. And yet, I mean, that's what people in the 1920s and 30s thought. They didn't live their lives thinking that they are horrible people. They were not thinking that I'm going to abuse this or that. They were sort of practicing in their own time frame. So we don't want to say it was perfectly fine, which I do not say in my book. I'm not saying that it's okay for doctors to have sexual relationship with patients without consent or whatsoever. Just because their time period was limited and different from ours, I'm not saying that that's okay. But I think it doesn't help us understand why they did what they did, why they felt in the way they felt. So that's where I really wanted to explore by kind of making a distinction between sort of experimental clinical environment that Sullivan created at Shepherd Pratt during the 1920s, and what I think to have become more problematic situation after he moved to New York City in his own clinic. So that's part of my effort to kind of think about history in a way that's sensible to what might look like a fine distinctions to our modern perception.
Do you think it was totally a product of his time, or that there was something else he could have done? Do you think there was that he had more awareness, he could have done more, or was it just so embedded in the time that he practiced that he didn't distinguish, he didn't do more for homosexuality since he was a gay man, that he could have done more?
Of course, we can all do more. I think about myself all the time. I could do much better. And I think he could have in the universal sense. But I also like to point out how when, for instance, one of my chapters talks about how in 1928 and 1929, he attended this colloquium called Personality Colloquium, and that involved not only psychiatrists and psychologists, but also anthropologists and political scientists and so forth, people from the social sciences, including, leaders from the famous Chicago School of Sociology, who were really the leading school in the field at that time. They are the founding fathers of U.S. modern social sciences. Some mothers as well, by the way.
Ruth Benedict and Margaret Mead.
Yes, exactly. Even though, come to think of that, I don't know if Margaret Mead or Ruth Fulton Benedict prefer the term mother because they were, sexual minorities themselves. I really don't know what kind of gender identity they might have had, even though I think they publicly pronounced themselves to be women. But that was beside the point. So in those personality colloquiums, Sullivan really tried to talk about homosexuality and something that could be read as his effort to encourage the better acceptance of sexual minorities in public. And that's a huge deal for the late 1920s. I think it's, even if it happened now, it's somewhat courageous thing to do. So what he was doing was to kind of talk about how we might see homosexuality from not a pathological view, but as somebody that is feel that they are not well, not because of the fact that they are sexual minorities, but because of the fact that society looks down upon it. And B, isn't there any better quality that they might possess because of the fact that they are sexual minorities? He was really reaching out to that line of discussion. And this is in the 1920s, right, when people are sort of breaking gender and sexuality boundaries in many other different ways. You know, we hear a lot about flappers and, you know, women and men who were beginning.
The jazz age, and yes.
Yeah, right. So I think he had enough of a basis that he detected in public and social realms there that might help him to make those accepting arguments about sexual minorities. So I think given that, he did quite a bit. And I admire him for that.
Yeah, I was thinking of, I don't know if you're familiar with the book, Treatment of a Young Male Schizophrenic, which is a kind of a transcript of a supervisory case of a young man. And I, whenever I read this, and I use it for teaching, and I go over it quite often, I think of the conflation between that seems to come across in that about homosexual urges and schizophrenia. Like if you read the case, it's almost quite clear that the person wouldn't be called schizophrenic nowadays, you know.
Yeah.
And also that he may have had some urges, but it wasn't the focus of it. But yet there was this kind of a lot of discussion about the homosexual urges and schizophrenia together.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I think that's in his published work, Sullivan's published work as well, that he saw some correlation between schizophrenic symptoms and homosexual inclinations. But I also think it's important for us to note that it's not as though all the patients that I looked at the clinical records of Shepard Pratt who were diagnosed with schizophrenia had homosexual experiences or feelings or other way around. In other words, there are people who really seem to have had severe symptoms of schizophrenia in addition to their troubled feeling about their sexual experiences and feelings. So I think it's true that those two things are oftentimes bound together, but in other cases, they are not necessarily, you know, overlapping concepts.
And also, I guess there was some sense that that to have a homosexual identity was almost like a little less than, or a step along the maturational scale towards heterosexual development, that this was kind of a problematic concept.
Yeah, exactly. Absolutely. So Sullivan was part of that school of thought, even though he was, like I said earlier, in connection with 1928 and 29 colloquium, pushing for testing a line of theory that would counter such an argument of immaturity. I think that's what you're talking about.
Mm-hmm.
The Freudian, you know, theory had that idea. Harry Stack Sullivan had that idea that, you know, you go through this phase of being a sexual minority and then you grow out of it one day and all will be very happy and you'll be happy as well. He tried out that line of thinking with one of his patients at Shepard Pratt, as a matter of fact, only to be refuted by the patient. Mm-hmm. You know, the patient kind of responded, yes. Yeah, by saying that, well, but I mean, what about you? You know, you look like a grown up and then you seems to be a homosexual man as well.
Yes, that was very interesting in the book and how he challenged him back.
Yes, exactly. Yeah.
And then he kind of used that same line of thinking right in during the war, right? Because he was involved in selection of people for the draft or in setting up the criteria for acceptance into the army in World War II? Was this and he used some of this as well, right?
Yeah. So, I mean, it was a big deal. I mean, it was the first U.S. military system to screening in and out of people based on their sexual orientations. So once you are found to have engaged in or even have an inclination to have same-sex sexual desires, then you are out. And Sullivan was the chief architect of that screening criteria. So that was obviously late 1930s and early 1940s. But that's when Sullivan was really a nationally respected psychiatrist. And that's the reason, the very reason why he was mobilized, recruited for this national project of a great importance and consequences.
What led to his national fame? How did he go from being a doctor at Shepherd Pratt to kind of this practice to becoming kind of nationally known?
That's a really good question.
I just thought of it now. I was curious. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. I think, you know, he had encounter with, you know, right kind of people in many ways. I mentioned earlier that he had an interaction with leading, you know, social scientists even early on in the 1920s. And yeah, so he sort of, there was a time period, not necessarily now, but in the scholarship, when Sullivan was better known among, you know, social scientists more than he was among psychiatrists, and, you know, because of his work and publications that came out of his collaboration with anthropologists and political scientists, and so on. So I guess those kinds of connections probably, you know, push him to that position, but also who had an experience of working very closely with people who were kind of not exactly severely ill, but maybe early and acute cases. Not a lot of people or psychiatrists of the 30s had that kind of experience, because the majority of psychiatrists were still attendant at state mental hospitals. Now, of course, you know, by the 1920s and 30s, there are a select number of elite hospitals, such as Shepherd Pratt or Chestnut Lodge Hospital that you mentioned earlier, Chris, and Boston Psychopathic Hospitals, or maybe, you know, the Kansas Clinic, Topeka, like William Menninger's Brazos Clinic, and so on. Those are famous, but we shouldn't sort of forget how those hospitals are really select few places in the national scale, right? So lots of patients, as well as psychiatrists, were working at state hospitals, where, as you know, mostly the home for chronic long-term patients. So that means that there are only a limited number of psychiatrists who had an experience of working with people who are still in the early phase of mental confusion and illnesses. And that's exactly the kind of experience that was required for psychiatrists at the screening center, right? Because you are not looking at obviously sick people in that kind of situation. You are actually kind of looking at mostly healthy people. And your assignment is to be able to decipher who is likely to fall ill or who looks like he is or she is on the verge of becoming mentally ill. And I think that particular kind of experience that Sullivan had probably had much to do with how he was recruited.
Yeah, I had done an interview with Gail Hornstein, who had written the book on Frieda von Reichman, and a lot of that kind of overlaps this with the idea of that what a great set of circumstances. It was almost like a perfect set of circumstances that came together, because you had these hospitals where people were wealthier and they came there for longer stays, and also the good, in fact, being in the Washington area had something to do with good government insurance often. The people had good insurance policies, and these long-term treatments were covered, and it wasn't quite the same people that you got in the chronic hospital. So I guess in some way he must have known that and kind of decided to work with that group.
Yeah, yeah. And I think he was being ambitious too. I think he really believed in the social experiment or broader application of medical theories and practices, which I think was quite problematic. But yeah, so I think it was an exciting opportunity for him, even though he was very much deeply troubled by some of the things that he observed, including things like, you know, people are getting stigmatized even more by getting rejected by selective services. So I think he realized that his original intention was to do this great experiment mostly to protect people whom he cared about, including, you know, homosexual men, because his belief as a clinical psychiatrist at the time was that many people are psychologically and socially vulnerable, especially in a single-sex environment such as army or even schools, for that matter, because they might experience same-sex sexual desires for the first time when they are not quite ready to sort of digest it and when the society is not accepting of it. And then those are the reason why a person might actually have a psychological breakdown, including things like schizophrenia, as you mentioned earlier. So his intention was to protect those what he believed to be vulnerable individuals from the psychological breakdown by letting them serve in the army. And as it turned out, the screening system itself turned itself into a discriminative device as well. So I think he understood it and felt quite disappointed with that.
Did you come across any information about his own personal break, like the stories that he had a personal breakdown early on? I don't know there's kind of like a famous gap around there. I was wondering if you saw anything in the records about that as well.
Yeah, so if I run into any records whatsoever, I would have written a lot about it. I didn't write that much about it because I couldn't find anything beyond speculation and fragments. And those are different from historical evidence. And if I cannot collaborate a substantial number of evidence to speak to each other to sort of reconstruct at least a skeleton of a story, then that's just a story. It's not a history. So I draw a line there. And I really didn't find anything to share with you. There was not something that that existed in terms of what historical records told me.
One of his famous, you know, contributions concept is the detailed inquiry, and the book made me think about how much of that came from sociology, and I was wondering if. If he really gave credit where credit was due for that, you know, made me think about that he kind of gets credit for this concept in psychology, but really it's a sociological concept.
But I think, you know, sociologists,
even the participant observer, the detailed inquiry, yeah, seems to come from those sociological circles.
Yeah, that's true. That's very true. And the life history method that I talk a lot about in my book, I mean, it is, you know, what sociologists are really interested in doing, you know, and that was a very important kind of method because people are beginning to think that, you know, ordinary people probably matter much more than what we thought prior to that. Only the elite individual political leaders mattered or famous people mattered. Now they are thinking about immigrants and women and the poor and, you know, the residents of big cities. So therefore, sociologists had to sort of develop those new methodological devices, which was very exciting for them. But I think also they benefited from Sullivan's input into those methodologies as well. And I think, you know, there are other psychologists and psychiatrists who were part of this collaboration, and Sullivan was just part of it. But I think it was very much interactive and interdisciplinary processes that, you know, shaped what we know as interpersonal theory or life history, or, you know, we historians tend to refer to it as oral history when we interview people. That's definitely based on those traditions, scholarly and intellectual and clinical traditions that those people really helped create. So I think yeah, everybody should get a credit.
So it was mutually influenced. People went, it went both ways.
Right. Yeah, but come to think of it, what you said made me think of how, you know, even though he was really interested in getting stories out of people, wanting to understand this person, who is this person, what kind of this person is he, was really a scary question that Sullivan apparently asked many of his students that really was intimidating to many of them. I mean, some of his students, you know, mentioned that in their memoirs or notes and so forth. But I think, you know, it's kind of revealing that despite the fact that that's what he was pursuing throughout his work, he really left only fragmentary, you know, stories about himself. He didn't write diaries, and he didn't write tons of letters. I mean, he wrote some letters, but it's not a lot, which really made it difficult for anybody to try to sort of look into some of the basic facts about his life. So, I mean, it's a great contradiction, right?
Yeah. Well, that's the thing. It's like it's really clear how many contradictions he had. In other words, one of the, you know, well-known ones was his how he would treat his patients, which was usually very warmly, and then how he would treat the supervisees, where he was kind of a very difficult guy. He like you said, compartmentalized and split in so many ways.
Right, exactly. And some of his, you know, treatment of his patients were pretty stern as well. Oftentimes with female patients, but including some male patients as well. So it's not as though we can just sort of feel good about how he was really capable of understanding any patient and being able to warm and sympathetic to and compassionate to them. And I don't think that was true at all.
He didn't seem to work very often with female patients.
Yeah, although that became more extreme, I think, toward the end of his tenure at Shepherd Pratt. I think he did see some female patient aria in his work when he was not a clinical director and didn't therefore have a lot of opportunities to be choosy about which patients to work with. And I think, you know, the way Shepherd Pratt worked out, the sort of doctor-patient relationship was, to assign one main doctor, chief doctor, to a patient. But then lots of times patients would be seen and even interviewed by a team of doctors, right? So Sullivan may not have been a chief physician of a female patient, and yet, of course, he did have a lot of female patients that he, you know, looked at and worked with. Because he was one of the physicians on the team to care for this female patient. So, yes, he did have quite a few interactions with female patients, and that continued on after he moved to New York City as well in the 1930s.
And that was another key turning point in his life when he gave up his practice after New York. Was that correct? He kind of moved more into kind of a governmental and global role.
Uh-huh. Yeah, he was in administration and he was really not seeing patients anymore, which is really unfortunate for me, because what really drove my curiosity from the beginning was how he interacted with his patients and how he made sense of it and how it might have shaped even his own interpersonal relationship with his people. So I guess, you know, if he had seen a patient and left clinical records from the 1940s, that would have opened up an entirely different perspective among us who are left behind. But yes, you're right. He sort of really moved away from clinical practices. So it's an irony, especially if you think about it in combination with how he was taking up this big role at Selective Services in his screening processes, and he really became a famous, important person. And that really changed the way he's perceived by people, but also, I think, changed the way that he interacted with his collaborators. So that was another turning point, if you will.
I seem to have gotten the sense that he missed working with more severe people that after the private practice of seeing seeing higher people who are out in the world, that it almost seemed like it, from what I took away from the book, was almost seemed like it wasn't gratifying like the earlier work was.
Yeah, I think you're right. But I think he also didn't decide to go back to clinical practices either. I don't really exactly know why that was the case. I think he was consumed by his passion, consumed by his importance and genuinely significant tasks, such as, you know, creating the World Federation of Health and Federation of Mental Health, and then trying to come up with, in collaboration with psychiatrists and social scientists worldwide, some kind of standard to prevent from the war from happening. And it is an impossible task for anyone to really feel great about. But I think he felt passionate about it, and he felt that he could do something. He could make some important contribution to it. And that belief really kept him away from any possibility of going back to seeing patients.
It seemed like he was like in the right place at the right time, and he would also put himself in the right place. Like after the war, there seemed to be a very like a lot of optimism and ambition about kind of using institutions to change mental health and to kind of do these things. And he was right there, and kind of he both had a passion for it, but also had the opportunity to do something like that. It turned out later on wasn't necessarily successful, but that was the movement at the time. It seems.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and that was urgent feeling, the urgency that that was very taking shape after World War II. It was supposed to be a good war from the Allied powers perspective, but it was a good war because something horrible, plenty of horrible things happened in the war. So what to do with it in response was really an urgent issue for people who felt that they have something to contribute to the solution. But I also think that was the era when Western centrism and centric ideas, the idea that Western society is the one that has a solution to worldwide problems, as well as American exceptionalism, a belief that America has a unique responsibility and role to play in shaping the world dynamism, were very prevalent. And then I think eventually that was the limitation that made most of the, I shouldn't say most of, but a significant component of the project that Sullivan engaged himself in didn't materialize or failed.
Was James Inskow alive when you were writing the book, or he was? But you had access to some of the papers, and James Inskow was his life partner, I guess would be maybe the term.
Yes, right. So yes, he was already he had passed away, unfortunately. I'd be curious to know if he would have agreed to see me if he was still alive. But you're right. I did have a chance to look at some of his writings, mostly letters that he wrote to Helen Slick Perry, and I was allowed to look at those documents thanks to the Stuart Perry, the widowed husband of Helen Slick Perry. So I forever owed him for that. Mm-hmm. That was really great that he was willing to share those very sensitive and personal document with me. I know it doesn't happen with everybody. So I'm very much grateful for that, for Stuart. Yes, so he has a very neat handwriting. So even though the amount of document was pretty large, I was able to go through it very reasonably well. And he was good writer, very revealing about his relationship, his thoughts about his partner, Harry Stack Sullivan, but also not the one to use the most straightforward language for that. So it was not evasive or not secretive or anything, but I think it was very much open to interpretations. It was a challenging, but I really like to read his letters a lot.
I mean, as we've been talking, right, the book was pretty controversial and kind of overturns or exposes kind of a lot of stuff. What was the reaction to the book and to the from maybe the psychoanalytic community or from the interpersonal community? What kind of response did you get?
It varies so much. So it's just amazing for me to realize that people have strong reactions to it. And I shouldn't be surprised. I mean, in a sense, I'm not surprised. But I still was when I actually started to get so many different responses. So some people thought that, well, not necessarily a book per se, but some people I got in touch with an intention of finding something out about people's sexuality in the process of writing a book, was really upset. They were really upset because they felt that, you know, this person is a wonderful person and this person's sexuality should remain a private matter. So some of the things that shaped Erin Slick Perry's time, for instance, you know, 1970s and 80s, where sexuality was not supposed to be publicly talked about, even though there are tons of people who were talking about it. But this particular kind of sexuality, particular associated with famous and, you know, people that left lots of cherished memory to others, it was still a taboo. So there was a little bit of that. There are other people who felt that I didn't do enough. So some people thought that my sort of description of the disparity between public and private in, you know, social scientists and psychiatrists' approach to homosexuality was too harsh on them because they did their best given their time. It was a homophobic society at the time. We shouldn't be criticizing any homosexual individuals who try to do their best in their own circumstances. So the fact that I was sort of even talking about the public-private gap was not pleasing to those people. And I guess anything in between, right? So that was kind of surprising. And there are other people, fortunately for me, who are just really happy with that. And they kind of got my project in terms of how I wanted to show as many possible aspects as possible so that we can come up with at least some reasonable, well-grounded interpretation of the past. So by not just talking about them, but being able to sort of use all those observations to get to know him, his people, and his time better. I think many people got that. That was where I was going with that. So that was probably most pleasurable for me. But you're right. I think there are quite a few variations in terms of how people responded to it.
What do you think the effect on Sullivan's legacy? What do you think it's been? What do you think? How do you think we should consider Sullivan going forward from here?
I think he certainly is somebody who offered many wonderful, inspiring theories and ideas, and his clinical practices. I wish I could see them, right? Just by looking at clinical records, word-for-word exchanges between him and his patients, I think he was a very, very talented, unique clinician. So we can appreciate him for that. And also we can appreciate for how he struggled with what he saw to be his problem, his weakness, something that he grappled with, which is his sexuality, and did his best to sort of do something with it. I think, you know, I tend to think of or respect individuals when their life is sort of underpinned by some current of pain. And then they still sort of, you know, live with that. But I think, I mean, that kind of applies to most of us. But then I really admire individuals even more when I see those people being really keenly aware of that pain, where it comes from, and how they are living with that, and then try to do something with it. And I think Sullivan did just that, right? So be it with his patients in a relatively protected clinical environment, but in also, you know, more open public spaces such as academic conferences. And even though its consequence was highly problematic, the screening system was also something that he tried to implement with good intentions, so to speak. So I think I would want him to be understood in that light as well, which is neither romanticizing or, hypercritical. I think it's something else that I am trying to get at here.
I think it just provides a fuller picture for all of us who admire Sullivan's work and still use the theoretical concepts, and it just gives another perspective. And I think it was just a great book. I really enjoyed reading it, and I think it's a great contribution, actually. Do you want to speak for a moment about what you're doing now? You're no longer you're not writing about psychoanalysis, but if you'd like to speak about your latest project, please do.
Yeah, thank you. I'm happy to. Just make sure that it doesn't get too long. I think historians just love to talk about their own project, especially the ones that's torturing them right now. So I am writing a book about American survivors of Hiroshima and Nagasaki, and they are little-known Asian Americans who happen to be there in Japan as of 1941. So their history compared to the history of Japanese survivors of the A-bombing in 1945, or even Korean survivors of the same instance, is very little known. I have conducted about 90 oral history interviews with those Asian American survivors of Hiroshima and Nagasaki, and I am trying to write something about it. Their history is very complicated, and I think their description, the way I describe the American survivors, would be very similar to the way I describe Sullivan, actually. you know, somebody who lives with a pain, but also tries to do something about it, with it. And clearly they have had a long history of struggle to have their radiation illnesses recognized both by Japanese and American governments, and in many cases by Korean governments as well, because they include not only Japanese Americans, but also Korean American survivors. So three countries, nation states, are involved in this. So it's a transnational history that sort of try to understand survivors' memory and identity. And much of it is actually, you know, how they kind of grapple with the notion of illness. So when I mentioned, you know, radiation illness earlier, because obviously that's one main problem that survivors of nuclear weapons suffer from. But I guess we tend to think of it in medical and statistical sense, but I'm more interested in radiation illness in a social and psychological sense. So in some ways, you know, it's not all that different from my first book because of that kind of connection. Yeah. So, but that's what I'm working on now.
So are you working on it now and anticipate maybe next year?
I wouldn't be that optimistic. I'm working on my first draft right now, so it will be done by the end of this summer, crossing my fingers. But the publication will be probably 2 years out. That's my best guess. Some of my articles are coming out, so I'm very excited. And you know, I want to do the right thing for this project, obviously. Some of the people I interviewed are passing away. You know, youngest people I talked to were in their late 60s because obviously they're old. So I do feel a sense of urgency that we have to preserve their voices before they are all gone. And I'm actually concurrently, as my book writing, working on this project to preserve their oral history interviews that are digitally recorded. And I'm trying to sort of partner with museums and archives to make sure that we don't lose those people's voices. So that's, yeah.
That sounds wonderful. I'll be looking forward to it. So I think we'll be finishing now. So I just want to say thank you so much for this interview. We've been speaking to Nauko Wake, the author of Private Practices, Harry Stack Sullivan, The Science of Homosexuality and American Liberalism. Thank you so much for being with us today.
Yeah, thank you very much. I really enjoyed talking with you and great questions. I really appreciate it. Thank you.
Great. Take care.